investigation?
Holly and Lauren? They didn't do anything.
For one thing, the cops will want to test them for rape.
But they weren't raped.
Everything you tell the cops will be second-guessed. It always is. These days, no one takes anyone's word for what happened without looking at how else it might have happened.
But that's not right.
It's what it is. It'll be a big story. Everyone will be talking about what happened here. Did it happen one way? Did it happen another? Speculation whether Holly and Lauren were molested. Always speculation. They'll have to live with that. Boys in school will torment them about it, and not just boys. Sandra's ashen cheeks pinked, whether with a reflection of the retreating sunlight or mortification. Children can be cruel. Are you a widow, Sandy?
Widow?
No. Divorced. Was there a custody fight? The woman's expression answered the question. If it was an ugly custody battle, it'll be worse the second time around. Sandy, you didn't endanger the girls by taking them on this road trip, but he'll argue that you did. And there are going to be people who agree with him. Maybe not the judge, but there will be a lot of self-appointed judges who will tell you what they think. Chewing her lower lip, Sandra stared out at the darkening land, at the headlights of the westbound traffic on the farther side of the highway.
What if the police find them and think I killed them?
Nobody's going to think Sandy Termondale killed anyone.
I don't even own a gun.
This territory is wild. It's a long way down the embankment. They won't be found for weeks. Coyotes will be at them. Sandra shuddered. We want coyotes, Sandy. Unless the cops have DNA evidence on file from previous arrests, there will be so little left they'll never be identified. And there's no way they can be linked to you. Sandra's life to date hadn't prepared her for how to deal with violence or how to minimize the after effect. She seemed unable to look at Jane.
What about the blood?
Clean it up. You and your mom. Come on, Sandy. It's almost dark enough to do the job. She grimaced.
What about the other two? What if they come looking for us after we're on the road again?
When they come back here and don't find you, they'll know something went very wrong. They aren't going to chase trouble.
But what if they do?
Where were you planning to stop tonight?
There's an RV campground near Gallup. We have a reservation.
That's almost 200 miles. They won't look that far. But I'll tell you what. I'm going that way. I'll follow you, make sure you're safe in Gallup before I leave you.
I'm never going to feel safe again anywhere.
To an extent, that's a good thing. Finally, the woman met Jane's eyes.
Maybe your name is Alice Liddell.
But who are you?
What are you? What do I tell my girls?
Tell them I'm the Lone Ranger's granddaughter. Tell them I'm a guardian angel. You'll think of something.
A guardian angel with a gun?
Jane smiled. Michael, the archangel, always has a sword. Others, too. Maybe even angels have to change with the times. When Sandra looked away, Jane reached out, put a hand beneath the woman's chin, and gently brought her eye to eye again. Your girls were victimized, Sandy. End that here. Don't make them victims for the rest of their lives. Help them be brave. That entreaty might have brought tears to Sandra's eyes a few minutes earlier. Not now. She had come to a terrible but essential acceptance, and she would never be the same. Let's do it. Chapter 11. The back door on the starboard side opened outward, screening them from eastbound traffic approaching on the long straightaway. Head shaven, one ear diamond studded, Heart stopped and caged in a clutch of shattered bone, stripped of ID, Egon Yuri Litvinov resisted, in death, the disposal of his corpse, perhaps 200 pounds of stubborn villainy that at times seemed animate, as if his disembodied but lingering spirit strove with limited success to gain entry to his flesh again. When they got him out of the motorhome and held him half erect between them, Jane peered around the open door that shielded them from oncoming headlights and waited for a gap in traffic. Except for a deep purple stole of last light outlining the crown of the distant hill, the sky was black with stars, the moon low with its ghost light of reflected sun. A long-haul big rig shrieked past, nothing immediate in its wake. They half-dragged and half-carried their burden to the nearby guardrail, its curved cap of metal well-designed for their purpose, laid him down across it as if he were curled there in drunken regurgitation, took him by the feet, and upended him so that he landed on his back on the slope beyond. He was rolled onto his side by the shifting action of the gravel stone that layered the steep incline. The scree began to slide, conveying him downward. His weight being greater than that of the small stones that transported him, his momentum increased beyond theirs as he rolled, and with a boisterous flailing of arms and legs, he vanished into low darkness. They could hear him in continuing descent until he met wild brush and tumbled through it to a stillness. Once as fresh-faced as an altar boy, still neatly barbered, in faded black denim and cowboy boots, stripped of ID, Lucius Kramer Bell weighed perhaps 40 pounds less than Litvinov and was more accepting of his death than had been his associate. During another break in traffic, they brought Bell more easily to the guardrail and tipped him over. By some fluke of physics or of the musculoskeletal performance of the post-mortem human form, Bell rolled into a sitting position on the sliding gravelstone, as if the scree were snow and he were sledding, repeating a happy moment of his childhood, inspired by one last feeble memory firing in his cooling brain. He went down into his darkness with macabre flair and followed Litvinov into the thrashing brush. Jane had taken off her sport coat to avoid soiling it, but she had gotten blood on her hands. She waited in the open doorway of the bathroom as Sandra, looking as grim as if she had just executed two men instead of only helping to dispose of bodies, repeatedly soaped her hands and rinsed them in stinging hot water until the lather no longer bubbled with even the faintest pink of gore. The girls were in the breakfast nook with their grandmother, out of sight, around the corner. Later, they would spend the night on the living area floor, sleeping, if sleep would find them. When Sandra stepped aside and snatched a towel from the rack, Jane took her turn at the sink, scrubbing away the last of Litvinov and Bell. She dried her hands on the same towel, and Sandra took it from her to hang it on the rack. Throughout these ablutions, neither said a word, nor did they speak now when Sandra suddenly put her arms around Jane, held her close and very tight. Jane returned the embrace, and they stood a while in a fierce silence, the mother of Holly and Lauren not able to put into words her tumult of emotions, the mother of Travis in no need of hearing words. She understood too well that this woman had come reluctantly into possession of the truth of the world, from which most people spent their lives in flight and denial. Once truth was known, it could not be unlearned, nor could it be forgotten, but lay always in the heart, a darkness for which all the years ahead would be spent seeking whatever light could be found to compensate. Chapter 12. Beyond the road and the headlights and the endless rush of restless humanity, out in the deep darkness of this ancient land, Meteor Crater lay in quiet testimony, as deep as a 50-story building was tall, 4/5 of a mile wide, older even than the settlements of the Anasazi Indians that had lain in ruins, silent in this same dark, even before Europeans ever walked this territory. Whatever hurtling mass, asteroid or other, could turn rock to powder by its impact, so had time and violence and cannibalism done to the Anasazi when village turned against village. In a mortal frame of mind, Jane Hawke followed the Termondale motorhome to Winslow, on to Holbrook, past the painted desert and the petrified forest, all the way to Gallup, New Mexico, where she saw them checked into the RV park and said goodbye. The nocturnes and preludes of Chopin, well performed by various pianists, accompanied her through the lonely red rock night across the Continental Divide. None of these piano masters was her famous father, who for his crimes had escaped not merely justice but also all suspicion, who remained even now on tour, his companion being the woman for whom he'd murdered Jane's mother when Jane was 8 years old. He was a brilliant musician. Though he could not master everything equally, he avoided Chopin. A collection of aching muscles and stiff joints, she arrived in Albuquerque at 11:20 p.m., almost 16 hours after watching Travis ride away on his pony. She found a motel that might have been rated 2 stars by a generous critic, paid cash, signed the register with the name on the driver's license that bore a photo of her with long auburn hair and green eyes, and made no request for a wake-up call. She had with her a half-empty pint bottle of vodka, and she bought a Coke from the vending machine. After a shower, she sat abed with a drink and turned over and over in her right hand 2 objects. First, the cameo that her boy had found and given her for good luck, and then the wedding band that the trucker, Foster Oswald, warned her to stop wearing. The wide gold band was not plain, but engraved as Nick had wanted, with his chosen words stacked in 2 lines and made black with inlaid enamel. You are my beginning and my end. He had believed they would enjoy a long life together, followed by a life thereafter. Just 6 years later, he was gone, selected by a computer model for extermination. Sometime in the 11th century, the rulers of the Anasazi Indians had sought to perpetuate their power by turning one group against another, identifying social outcasts for execution and cannibalizing them. The reign of terror became so great for so long that families built cliff dwellings as high as 600 feet above the canyon floors, defensible habitations accessed at considerable peril. What had changed in 1,000 years? Contemporary terror could be administered with greater efficiency than existed back then, the targets chosen by the application of metadata analysis. The weapons with which power-mad elites could enforce their rule were far more effective than the knives and clubs of old. And a millennium after the Anasazi, no one could escape merely by building a home in the side of a cliff. Jane mixed a 2nd drink. Later, on the edge of sleep, she slipped the wedding band on her finger. If she dared not wear it in public, she could still wear it in private. And if she could not have Nick any longer in this world of treachery and cataclysm, there had better be a life hereafter. There had better be. Chapter 13. On Monday, Sheriff Luther Tillman would take a 2-hour nonstop flight from Minneapolis to Louisville, Kentucky, and drive a rental car to Iron Furnace, where something of consequence seemed to have happened to Cora Gunderson that might have led to her fiery act of madness, although he could not imagine what that might have been. Now, after Sunday lunch, he sat at the computer in his home office, trying to learn more about the conference to which Cora had been invited, all expenses paid. Hazel Sievertson had remembered the sponsor as being the Seedling Foundation, but it turned out to be the Seedling Fund, a charitable organization with a significant endowment, founded and financed by a wealthy entrepreneur, Mr. T. Quinn Eubanks of Traverse City, Michigan. Googling Eubanks resulted in a slew of links, and the discovery that he had committed suicide the previous October, 2 months after the conference at the Iron Furnace Lake Resort. He had left his home on Grand Traverse Bay, driven out to Old Mission Peninsula, parked near a cherry orchard, the largest concentration of such trees in North America, where he stood on a camp stool he'd brought with him, tied a short rope to a sturdy limb, fashioned a noose, tightened it around his neck, and kicked the stool out from under himself. His wife and business associates appeared to have been shocked and mystified by the suicide. He had not been ill, never suffered a day of depression, and had every reason to live. A fellow board member of the Seedling Fund, the billionaire David James Michael, had delivered a moving eulogy during the memorial service, at which he announced that he would contribute $10 million to the fund in T. Quinn's honor. Through the Seedling Fund, Eubanks had been the primary sponsor of the conference on techniques for teaching special needs children. According to the fund's website, he had also been at the five-star resort in Iron Furnace for the entire 4 days. Sensitized to curious patterns by years of police work, Luther thought it significant that two attendees should subsequently kill themselves in the space of 5 months. He wondered if there might have been a third suicide, or a death by violence, or a suspicious accidental death, among others who had been at the event. The website didn't offer a list of those who had been invited, and provided only a cursory explanation of the purpose of the conference. Curious. A charitable foundation with a mission usually promoted its goals and activities at every opportunity, as a matter of pride and in furtherance of its objectives. Indeed, the fund's other projects were described at much greater length. Hazel Sievertson had remembered that those invited to Iron Furnace Lake Resort had been recipients of Teacher of the Year awards from their cities or states, not necessarily in the same year, but at some point in the past. Nationwide, over a couple of decades, many hundreds of teachers would have received that honor. But when Luther searched for any connection between the phrase Teacher of the Year and Iron Furnace Lake, he found none. His first thought was that Hazel misremembered. But 2 hours later, having used every search string he could think of, he had been unable to turn up even a single name of a conference attendee other than T. Quinn Eubanks. He couldn't even find Cora's name. It was almost as if the event never occurred, or as if it had been held. But then something happened during those 4 days to unsettle and embarrass the people at the Seedling Fund to such an extent that they wished to minimize references to the entire affair. Having found the name of the primary officer of the fund, Lisa Tosca, and her phone number, his first inclination was to call her in the morning before he caught his early afternoon flight to Louisville. But that night, after dinner, he stepped outside to stand on the back porch steps, coatless in the cold air, gazing at the sky, listening to the stars, as Rebecca fancied it. Sometimes, as now, when he stood here, troubled by something about a case, he was not sure what was nagging at his subconscious. In time, the stars must have spoken to him, because he realized that he should not call Lisa Tosca, lest word of his having done so reached Booth Hendrickson. The Department of Justice attorney had given him a statement, platitudes and cornpone, to read before news cameras, as if the incident at the Veblen Hotel were an elementary school play and Luther a child who needed to study his few lines before making his parents proud by performing his walk-on part, as if the public's fears about yet another mass murder could be massaged away by the right messaging, by meaningless reassurances in simple language. But none of the clichés applied this time. This horror had not been perpetrated by a lone wolf gunman of any flavor, nor was it workplace violence, nor a payback for social injustice that everyone must be encouraged to understand, if not approve. To soothe the public, Hendrickson and other political fixers would have to be more creative than usual. By the time they were done with Cora, they would have reinvented her as a live-alone freak outsider, a cunning sociopath capable of passing herself off as a caring schoolteacher who in secret collected Hitler memorabilia, mutilated herself with needles and knives, drank her own urine as a health cure-all, and probably molested the special needs children who had been entrusted to her. Just another nut. Nothing to see here. Everyone move along. That's why they torched her house. To erase evidence of the real Cora's private life. To make of her a blank canvas on which they would be able to paint whatever they wished. The truth of Cora's descent into madness and fire was being covered up. Therefore, it must be an ugly truth, but also a wrecking ball, huge and terrible. A wrecking ball that, if ever made public, would bring down Booth Hendrickson and those who employed him. Now, Luther fully understood why he could not call Lisa Tosca at the Seedling Fund. Knew he must go to Iron Furnace as a private citizen and with discretion. And so he ceased merely to stare at the stars in contemplation. He began instead seeking constellations, to comfort himself that the vastness above remained ordered as it had always been, regardless of the disorder here below. Perhaps worry and weariness befuddled him, for he could not find Cassiopeia, or Pegasus, or Leo Minor, or Lynx, or Hercules. As if the universe as it had been through the previous night changed with the latest sunset, groups of stars no longer suggestive of shapes and symbols. The coldness of these strange new heavens brought to the night a deeper chill, and although he told himself his failure to discern the ancient designs was, yes, a consequence of worry and weariness, he went shivering into the house, where things would be as they had been, a consoling domesticity. Chapter 14. On the road at 7 Sunday morning, eating takeout egg sandwiches from a diner, leaving Albuquerque with no respect for speed limits, Jane chose Antoine Domino, the immortal Fats, for company. Fats rocking his piano. Her father would sneer. To Amarillo, and, without music, on to Oklahoma City, 556 miles in 8 hours. She pushed 3 hours more, one through a storm, plump white raindrops like threads of pearls, lightning in sheets of flame through a sky invisible, trees swooning in the wind. Somehow, the appropriate music was Rachmaninoff playing the Corelli variations. She stopped Sunday night at 6:05 in Fort Smith, Arkansas, with the intention of rising before dawn, staying to the speed limit in the more densely populated, more policed territory ahead, to reach Bowling Green, Kentucky, in 12 hours. That would put her within 2 hours of Iron Furnace on Tuesday. Another dinner of takeout, eaten in a motel room. After a shower, she sat in bed with a vodka-spiked Coke. In the low lamplight, every article of furniture and every cheap art print on the walls seemed identical to those in the room where she'd stayed in Albuquerque, identical as well to the contents of all the many rooms in which she had endured other nights alone, under names that were not hers. The farther she traveled, the more she seemed to go nowhere, as if the roads and changing landscapes were illusions. The violent encounters merely episodes of some virtual reality drama in which she had become trapped. She turned out the lamp and sat in the dark, propped up with pillows. An accomplished pianist, she had forsaken a career as a performer, but music at times played in her mind as clearly as if from a radio. Now, She heard Simon and Garfunkel's, the sound of silence, and she sang softly, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." But it wasn't the darkness that summoned that song from memory. It came to mind because both the lyrics and melody spoke of the world as she now knew it, of alienation, oppression, loneliness, and apocalypse. She slept, and later woke in a condition she allowed herself only in sleep. She didn't know if she had dreamed of finding her mother, or of finding Nick dead of an apparent suicide. Perhaps she found both, as she'd found them often before. All she remembered was a dream of blood and anguish. In sleep, she allowed herself to weep, her face wet with tears. But tears while awake were a weakness, an invitation to the wicked who fed on them. So she turned on her side and drew her legs up in the fetal position and returned to sleep, where she was safe when she sought the relief that tears provided. Chapter 15. As a lawman, Luther Tillman had an aversion to the kind of speculation that led to emotionalism and sensationalism, that took an ordinary case with a few oddities and ballooned it into a sordid melodrama involving conspiracies by wire-pulling villains larger than life. Under the current circumstances, however, maybe a straw wasn't necessary to break the camel's back of that aversion. Perhaps a feather was enough to do the job, the feather being his inability to identify long-familiar constellations in the night sky. But whatever the cause, something tipped Luther Tillman over the edge after Sunday dinner. Because he wouldn't have time on Monday to purchase disposable cell phones, he committed an act of evidence tampering of which he wouldn't have been capable a day earlier. He drove to headquarters, entered the evidence room alone, and took two disposable cells from a sack of 12 unactivated phones confiscated in the bust of a methamphetamine operation that had not yet gone to trial. As an item of evidence, 10 phones served as well as 12, didn't they? There would be a discrepancy in the evidence records, but sometimes that happened quite innocently. Home again, he made the necessary call to activate both phones, and he gave one to Rebecca.
While I'm in Kentucky, keep it charged and on. If I need to call you, I don't want to use either your iPhone or mine, and I don't want to call the house landline.
Scowling, Rebecca said, "Are you maybe letting this thing with Cora push your spook me button a little too hard?"
"No," he said, "I'm not."
Chapter 16. Clouds banked the moon. The lake pooled black from shore to shore, and silence lay on the waters. Even the insects of the early darkness now quiet in the wake of midnight. In daylight, no escape could succeed. Harley had tried several times. At night, the dark forest resisted navigation, and a flashlight drew them, whoever they were, whatever they were, as a porch light summoned flurries of moths. The woodland confounded like a maze, an intertwined raveling of white oaks and sugar maples and black walnuts and dogwoods, but it was not a maze to them, the imposters. They navigated the wilderness as though they had planted every tree themselves, according to some master plan that they had memorized. Harley Higgins, who had hours earlier celebrated his 14th birthday, crept along the shore, avoiding the sand that would take clear footprints. He crossed onto the grounds of Iron Furnace Lake Resort and made his way to the small marina. During the day, the resort rented motorized duffy boats, rowboats, and pontoon bicycles that tourists could pedal along the scenic shore. At 2 o'clock in the morning, no staff attended the place, and it stood at a safe distance from the hotel. A duffy offered the fastest way across the lake. They were equipped with electric motors, so there would be no noise to bring the imposters down on him. but for one of those he needed keys, which were in the locked marina office. The rowboats were tied in their slips, a pair of oars shipped in each. He sat on the dock and hooked his feet over the gunwale of a boat and pulled it against the pilings and dropped down into it with a stealth that pleased him, although then the vessel bumped against the pilings, a hollow thump that might have drawn attention if anyone had been nearby to hear it. On his knees at the transom, he used an oar to push off from the sliphead, and the boat glided into open water, raising no sound other than the burble and slish of the lake parting around it. Harley sat mid-vessel on the rowing thwart, facing the bow, and used the oar as if poling a gondola, pushing against the lake bed, propelling the boat slowly away from the docks and turning it north with the intention of transiting the lake to the farther shore. When the water grew too deep to pole the boat, he had to face the stern, risk socketing the oars in the oarlocks, and row in the conventional manner. The locks were well lubricated, but they still creaked softly as they swiveled, and he let the boat glide as far as it would on each stroke to avoid making too much noise near shore. He was not afraid of the lake. Nothing dangerous lived in it. But even if there had been sharks and alligators, he would have swum its width to escape if there had been no boat. For a few weeks, he had been on his best behavior, as if he had at last resigned himself to his new life. He ceased arguing with the adults, stopped trying to organize a rebellion among the children. He even pretended to enjoy his birthday, the ice cream and cake, as if the giftless celebration wasn't a mere charade. He stopped complaining of being imprisoned. They didn't call it prison, of course. They called it school, although no one attempted to teach him anything and had no expectation that he would learn. There were no classes, no textbooks, no lessons. He and the other 7 kids were allowed TV and video games and anything they wanted to amuse themselves and pass the time. They were not, however, permitted to interact with anyone who was not a citizen of the town. The imposters pretended that what they did to him and the other kids was normal, the way things had been done for generations. They even seemed to believe what they said, though it was all a humongous load of bullshit. The imprisonment had begun 10 months earlier, in May of the previous year, just 2 months after Harley's 13th birthday. Did they think he couldn't remember what his life had been like then? That he'd been free to ride his bike into town? That he had been bussed 11 miles to a real school at the county seat? The soft landscape lighting of the resort receded slowly to the south. When he looked left, east, the lights of town, such as they were at this hour, glimmered faintly 4 miles away. The west shore lay at a greater distance, and though there were many homes along its arc, they were dark now. Most of the north flank of the lake, toward which he rowed, remained in its natural state. He intended to beach the boat there and find his way along the tree line to a meadow that would provide an easy path to Lakeview Road. Lakeview would lead to the county highway. Perhaps there he could flag down an 18-wheeler and convince the driver to take him to the county sheriff's office or even to the state police. Truckers were good folks. They worked hard, and you could trust them. That's what Harley's uncle, Virgil Higgins, had always said before he ceased to be Uncle Virgil anymore, having been replaced by an imposter. Now, no one should believe any damn thing the man said. Harley didn't know if he could persuade the police that the people in Iron Furnace had changed, that they weren't who they had once been, but he felt confident that he could raise in them enough suspicion to wonder why all the kids in town under the age of 16, 8 of them, had been pulled from public schools on the same day, thereafter to attend a private school. When the cops investigated and saw the setup that the imposters called a school, they would know at once that it was, in fact, a prison. Perhaps a third of the way toward the farther shore, Harley began to row harder and faster, unconcerned about the noise he made, even if sound might carry well across water. In time, though fit and athletic, he began to tire. His arms grew heavy, as if they were stone grafted to him, and the vertebrae in his neck seemed to be made not from bone, but from woven bundles of nerves grown hot and sensitive with his effort. The lake lay wider at night than it appeared to be in daylight. Even in this moonless pitch, he couldn't have become disoriented, because the resort lights marked the south shore, and due east remained fixed by the lights of town. He told himself not to worry, just to keep rowing. But he rowed and worried until abruptly the bow draft ran aground. He shipped the oars and abandoned the boat and splashed through the shallows onto the north shore. Here, the beach was shingle rather than sand, the pebbles click-clattering underfoot, his wet sneakers squishing as he hurried east along that pale width, the lapping water to his right, a rampart of trees to his left. Although the south shore and the lake itself lay clear, a thin mist shawled the trees here and seemed to smoke up from the stones. The wet air curdled thick with the scent of forest mast. He arrived at an inclined meadow and turned north and climbed through wild grass and the faint sweet rot smell of last autumn's mayapple that had decomposed into a rich compost. When he crested the slope, he came to Lakeview Road. On the farther shoulder of the blacktop two-lane, three vehicles awaited him, including his father's Range Rover. Five men had come for him, dark figures in the greater darkness, faces shadowed but paler than the rest of them. Lacking a moon or other light, their eyes were devoid of reflections, burnt holes in featureless sackcloth visages. The county route intersected with this road 3 miles to the west. With such a posse formed against him, Harley had no hope of getting 100 yards, let alone 3 miles. He would have been depressed if he had not been more than half expecting such an encounter. Although he hoped for escape, he had learned something valuable from this exercise, and the next time he made a run for it, he would surely elude them. For a moment, the men stood still and silent, the thin gauze of mist weaving among them in slow gray currents, as if they were not men at all, but instead rough spirits shaped by angry nature from the mold and mire of the forest, sent forth to war with humankind. Then, the imposter who called himself Boyd Higgins crossed the road and put a hand on Harley's shoulder.
"Come along now, son. You need yourself a good night's rest."
Harley pulled loose of him.
"Don't call me son. I'm not your son. There's birthday cake and ice cream left. You can have some before you go back to bed."
Nothing could be done but cross the blacktop to the Range Rover and get in the front passenger seat and buckle up and slump in the shoulder harness. The Rover was preceded by the Chevy Silverado, followed by the Honda Accord, as if these five men were escorting a dangerous mass murderer after a failed break for freedom.
"I hate you," the boy said.
"I'm not the least way hurt when you say that," the fake Boyd Higgins assured him. "'Cause I know you don't ever mean it."
"I mean every damn word."
"Don't cuss, son. It taints your soul. Your mother and I love you. We understand your condition, and we'll always love you and be there for you."
"I don't have a condition."
"It's what they call a personality disorder, Harley."
"Here we go again with this horse shit."
"Thank the Lord it's a disorder you'll outgrow. We know you're struggling right now, and we wish there was more we could do to ease you through this."
"So I've got some stupid personality disorder, huh?"
"That's right."
"Then why don't you take me to a psychiatrist, some head doctor somewhere?"
"The school is the best place for your treatment, Harley. You need to see your way clear about that."
"It's not a damn school. No teachers. No classes.
No lessons?
The fake father smiled and nodded.
It's not your usual kind of school. Like I told you before, it's a waiting school.
What sense does that make?
Still smiling, the imposter took one hand off the wheel and patted Harley's shoulder as if to gentle him out of his anger. Exasperated by that condescension, Harley said,
You're not fooling us. Not for a minute. All the kids know none of you is who you look like.
As you've said so often before. But that's just part of this here particular darn personality disorder, Harley. The sad idea that we're some kind of robots or pod people or something. You kids will outgrow it with treatment. Don't you worry yourself about that.
With treatment, huh?
That's right.
We aren't getting any damn treatment.
Don't cuss, son. It's unbecoming.
What stupid treatment are we getting?
More than you realize. You'll understand, in time.
They rounded the northeast corner of the lake. The town lay a few miles ahead.
You don't scare me, Harley said.
That's good, son. There's no reason for you to be scared. No one has raised a hand against you, and no one will.
The father thing looked identical to Boyd Higgins. He sounded like Boyd Higgins. But the real Boyd Higgins never lied to Harley or patronized him, and this guy was nothing but a patronizing, lying sack of shit.
You're a lying sack of shit.
The imposter smiled and shook his head.
You think so, 'cause of your condition, but that's sure to pass when you heal.
If you were really my dad, you'd punish me for saying a thing like that.
Well, now, if you'd lost your legs, son, I wouldn't punish you just 'cause you couldn't walk. And I surely won't punish you just 'cause of your condition.
Chevy Silverado, Range Rover, and Honda Accord passed through town in solemn procession. For a burg so small, Iron Furnace had a large number of gift shops and galleries and restaurants, all quaint, arrayed along a wide main street with brick sidewalks and antique street lamps. It flourished, not just because of the 200 or more rich guests who stayed at the always full five-star resort, but also because it was a popular day trip destination for people from as far away as Nashville and Louisville and Lexington. Big pemberry blue conifers with pendulous sprays of blue-green foliage lined both sides of the street. They were decorated year-round with thousands of tiny lights, which inclined the Chamber of Commerce to call this the town where it's always Christmas. This had been a great place to grow up, especially when your mom and dad owned Higgins's Haven, a combination sandwich shop and ice cream parlor. But it wasn't Harley's town anymore. He wasn't permitted to walk its streets. The old buildings and the businesses and the trees, not lighted at this hour, looked the same as they had always looked. But what had been welcoming and even magical to him in the past now appeared sinister. Outside of town, Lakeview Road turned west. 2 miles ahead lay the resort in all its splendor. Harley said,
So tell me again why it is you call the place a waiting school.
Well, now, though I've told you 100 times, I don't mind telling you again, if it helps you settle yourself. We call it the waiting school because this here condition you have, it mostly has to be cured by time. There's nothing to be done but wait the darn thing out.
Until I'm 16.
That's right.
Meanwhile, I'm in prison.
Now, Harley boy, don't torture my heart with such talk. You know it's not a prison. There's nothing you want you don't get, plus good food and fresh air and the finest care.
Harley wanted to scream. Just scream, scream, scream until he exhausted himself. He knew he wasn't crazy. But truly insane people screamed like that in asylums, didn't they? Instead of screaming, he said,
I've been reading a book about personality disorders.
Good for you.
Know thyself, as they say. I might want another book about them.
Then you'll have it, son.
We've gotten you all kinds of books you asked about. You know, we encourage you to read anything you want. Your mom and me, we don't care, whatever it is, even if it's spicy. Anything that keeps you interested and passes the time. You just have to stay in the school and pass the time.
What kind of personality disorder cures itself when you turn 16?
Why, the kind you have, son.
What's the name of it?
The imposter laughed, just like Boyd Higgins.
Lord bless me, boy. I spent my life making sandwiches and ice cream treats. My mind hasn't been shaped to remember 30-letter medical terms.
Why 16, exactly?
Well, now, as I understand it, the brain is still in some ways growing past 16, but that's the golden age when it's mostly matured. So when it's mostly matured, then you're ready.
Ready.
Ready as you'll ever be,
the imposter confirmed.
Ready for what?
Well, ready to be done with this condition you've got.
Overnight, you mean?
If my own poor brain understands it, that's right.
As they cruised past the entrance to the resort and kept going, Harley said,
2 years from today.
From yesterday, your true birthday. It'll be such a relief to us when you're cured, son, to have our Harley back like you used to be.
After a hesitation, Harley said,
Will I be like I used to be?
Why ever wouldn't you be? It's a passing condition.
They rode in silence, into the darkness, past the resort and farther west along the lake. Then Harley said,
Dad, doesn't it sound crazy, or at least weird, that every kid in town under 16 has the same condition, and they'll all be cured overnight when they turn 16, and until then they have to be kept locked up and away from people? Meanwhile, nobody's teaching them any schoolwork. They're just supposed to entertain themselves. When you think about it, Dad, doesn't it seem not just wacko, but plain wrong?
Boyd Higgins, if he was Boyd Higgins, frowned and stared at the road where the headlight beams intersected in the distance, and he remained silent for half a mile. Then he shook his head and smiled.
You don't need teaching, Harley, 'cause you'll know it all when you're 16.
Know it all? All what?
Everything you need to know, and nothing you don't need. You wait and see. You'll be all set when you turn 16.
4 miles past the resort, the Chevy Silverado slowed and hung a U-turn and headed back toward town. The Honda Accord followed it. The imposter slowed and turned right into a driveway that came to a tall gate flanked by stone walls receding into the night. He put down the driver's window and pressed a button on a call box and identified himself. The gate rolled aside.
Please don't do this,
Harley pleaded.
You'll be okay, son.
They care about you here.
It's like I'm going crazy.
But you're not, dear boy.
Maybe I am.
You're not. And you won't.
They passed through the gate and along the driveway toward the place that wasn't a school and never had been. Harley had told this man that he wasn't afraid of him, which was true. There were, however, things he feared. He feared spending 2 more years in this place. He feared his 16th birthday and what would happen then. He feared also that this Boyd Higgins was no imposter, that this might be his father, strangely changed, never to be as he had once been. The driveway led to the mansion. Under the pillared portico, two attendants, the woman who called herself Noreen and the man who called himself Harvey, waited there in a fall of amber light from the coffered ceiling. Man and boy got out of the Range Rover at the same time. The man came around the front of the vehicle and embraced Harley, because Boyd Higgins had always been a hugger. He kissed Harley on the forehead, then on the cheek, because Boyd Higgins had always been a kisser. He said,
"I love you with all my heart, son,"
because Boyd Higgins had always been generous in the expression of his love for his wife and child. Harley met the man's stare and saw the warm blue-green eyes that cherished him throughout his life. If he perceived sincerity in those eyes, sincerity and love, Harley recognized something else as well. A wimpling shadow in the depths, like he sometimes glimpsed on a sunny day when he was boating on the lake and he peered into the water and saw, at the farthest reach of light, a torsional finned form that seemed as mysterious as anything in this world of mysteries, yet could be known for what it was. However, the shadow in the deeper water of these eyes wasn't as clean and right as a fish in the lower currents of the lake, was instead a twist of torment, as if the man before him, in the saying of goodbye, felt tortured and knew, if only briefly, that something was gravely wrong. But then, the eyes shallowed away from those depths, and as if in the grip of some power demonic and unknowable, the man became insensate to the boy's misery. He smiled and got in the Rover and drove off, leaving Harley with the devastating and terrifying certainty that he had been driven here by neither a robot nor a pod person, but only by what remained of a good man named Boyd Higgins. Part 4. Iron Furnace. Chapter 1. Monday, on the flight from Minneapolis, Luther Tillman occupied himself with one of the thick, spiral-bound journals containing Cora Gunderson's handwritten fiction. He believed it offered her most recent compositions, because unlike the others of its kind, it was not filled to the end. About 100 lined pages hadn't been used. As before, he was captivated by her prose. In the middle of the volume, however, he found 2 pages reminiscent of the contents of the journal that he and Rob Stassen found on the woman's kitchen table, the obsessive repetition of phrases that slowly accumulated into a sentence about a spider laying eggs inside her skull. This repetition was of a different character. The lines of precise cursive warranted interpretation, but because the plane was making its approach to Louisville, he left that analysis for later. After renting a Chevrolet, Luther drove 2 hours to Morning Dove, Kentucky, 9 miles from Iron Furnace. He took a room in the Morning Dove Inn, which was no more an inn than it was a roller coaster, but only an ordinary mom-and-pop motel. Iron Furnace offered better motels, but Luther's name was more likely to come to the attention of Booth Hendrickson and the U.S. Department of Justice if it appeared on a motel registry in the town where Cora Gunderson had attended a conference of cloudy purpose. For his first visit to Iron Furnace, Luther dressed in gray slacks, a gray shirt, and a black sport coat, which he hoped would be acceptable later at the resort restaurant. The smelting of iron ore required a large supply of water, and the town had been flourishing by 1830. The industry there petered out after the turn of the century. The great furnace was long gone. Instead, Luther found a charming village with a 4-block colonnade of beautiful conifers, something called Pemberry Blues, with graceful aromatic sprays of foliage, unlike any evergreen in Minnesota. For an hour and a half, before the shops and galleries began to close, he wandered through them, chatting up the clerks and owners, who were unfailingly pleasant. If anyone asked, he was Martin Moses from Atlanta, a partner in an event planning firm. At 6 o'clock, he drove a few miles to the famous resort, where he was greeted by a valet whose black jacket had gold epaulettes and gold buttons and gold cuffs, and whose cap featured gold braiding on the visor. The rental car was received with no less enthusiasm than if it had been a Rolls-Royce. The three-story Wrightian structure seemed immense, long straight lines, gently sloped slate roofs overhanging deep eaves, cantilevered decks, dramatic stacked stone walls relieved by beige plasterwork. The stained glass windows were mostly of clear glass with color in the geometric border patterns. In the early dark, the windows glowed with warm, almost mystical light, as if herein the mortal guests could mingle with the gods and demigods of ancient civilizations who had descended from their pantheons. The interior exceeded expectations, from simple but striking decorative details in the silken-finished cherry-gold cedar ceilings to the luminous pale quartz floors with black granite borders. The restaurant staff wore modified tuxedos. Candles in baccarat crystal cups cast dancing prisms across the silver place setting. Scarlet amaryllis, gathered tightly in a glass bowl-shaped vase, seemed to tremble sensuously in the pulsating candle glow. The food was delicious, and without the slightest fault, the service impeccable, the waiter friendly. When Luther expressed a desire to pay cash, he was given no slightest reason to suppose that he might be thought gauche in this age of gold and platinum plastic. Because the valet was not busy, he chatted with Luther for a few minutes before bringing the rental car. He was well-spoken and thoroughly versed in the history of the town. 9 miles later, once more in the glamorless Morning Dove Inn, Luther hung his sport coat in the closet and used the bathroom. At the sink, washing his hands, he regarded himself in the mirror and said, "What the hell was all that?" He sat in an armchair, staring at a TV that he didn't bother to turn on, considering the town and resort that shared a name. He had experienced them not as a tourist, but as a cop at a crime scene. There had been no power lines, no telephone poles. Utilities were underground, an unusual condition for a village in a rural area. Of course, desiring a picturesque setting for tourists, the locals might have accepted the expense of prettifying the place. The streets were immaculate. If a tourist dropped a gum wrapper, someone must have been steps behind, picking up the litter. The sidewalks were so clean they might have been vacuumed. Gutters contained only needles from the evergreens, and not many of those. The owners of the quaint buildings appeared to have contracted their maintenance to industrious elves. Woodwork looked as if it had been painted yesterday. Everywhere else, time and weather leached mortar from between bricks and stones, but not an iron furnace. Zero graffiti. Not one dirty window or pane of cracked glass. The shops and galleries displayed merchandise with such an appreciation for orderliness that every business owner and employee might have been diagnosed with an obsessive-compulsive disorder. The people he'd met were so normal, in a 50s TV kind of way, like the cast of Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver, that their normalness was an abnormality in this era. Neatly groomed, nicely but never flamboyantly dressed, polite and well-mannered. No matter how effective an employer's training, you were sure to encounter an occasional salesgirl distracted by personal business or impatient for whatever reason, a gallery manager who was a bit of a snob, a scowling clerk, a waiter with attitude, but not an iron furnace. Everyone was efficient, attentive, informed about what they were selling, and none appeared to be dissatisfied with his job. A pleasant demeanor was so universal and unfaltering in Iron Furnace that Luther's cop intuition said not just that someone must be hiding something, but that all of them must be hiding something. Which was absurd. Paranoid. 600 residents? 600 people keeping a secret? Not possible. Anyway, what would the secret be? That every last one of them was flying high on some happiness drug? Another strange thing. As pleasant as everyone had been, he hadn't seen much of anything that could be called gaiety. No bright-eyed delight, no